All right, folks, we are back with another episode, and we're talking about all things African safari photography. It's a new segment that I like to call the All About series. So we're going to kind of go over everything from lens and gear considerations to your main photography techniques, even locations and times of day, how you travel, kind of, you know, dipping our toes in the logistics water of things as well. It's all about African safari photography today. So first up, we're going to talk about lens and gear recommendations. This is obviously a super important component, and there's so many different considerations, so many different iterations of what you can do, from advanced point-and-shoot cameras like the Sony RX10 that I'm just in love with, all the way to bigger, fancier DSLRs, and now, of course, with mirrorless today. But the first thing that I want to talk about, because this is usually the first question I get, is what's the right telephoto lens, or the best telephoto lens for an African safari? Well, we can go over and gloss over the whole, the best camera, the best lens is the one you have with you, obviously. But more importantly, I want to talk about, you know, what is going to give you the most versatility, what you're going to use the most, what you're going to like the most. And my default go-to/answer here is going to be one of the kind of super telephoto zoom lenses. And when I'm talking about this, I'm talking about the 100 to 400s, the 80 to 400s, the 200 to 500s, the 100 to 500s, you know, kind of that range where you're definitely not in the wide angle, you're definitely not using a classic landscape lens, and you're getting some real telephoto power. Now, there's an adage that I cite often that you really can never have, quote unquote, enough zoom. So when I say like the 100 to 400, I'm not saying that, you know, I would choose that and I don't want it to go to 600. It's just, you know, there's sort of pros and cons to all this, but yeah, getting up in the 4.5s and 600 millimeters, I think is really quite important for a general Africa safari lens. Now, when we talk about some of the locations here in a little bit, you know, different areas will allow you to get closer to wildlife, but typically a 100 to 400, at least that's my go-to. But I am thinking about investing in that new Canon 100 to 500, and I'm sure that's just going to make it all the much better. The lens that I will use for my quote unquote walking around lens, my landscape lens, my much closer wildlife lens is going to be my 24 to 105. A 24 to 70 also works great, but something that has a little bit of distance, something that has a, you know, a decent aperture. This one's an f4, but these are going to be really, really good for your general travel photography, landscape photography, and of course, close up wildlife photography as well. So I really, really, really like that lens, and it's about, you know, 30% of the time on my camera. The rest of the time, maybe 60 to 65%, I have my telephoto zoom on. And then that last little bit is when I'm going to be using my X factor lens. And then, you know, my X factor is, I use that as a term to talk about the lens I don't really need, but I'm going to bring because I have the space and weight. And I think it's really fun. And it might give me a couple really unique photos on the trip that could make it on the cover of my portfolio kind of thing, like a different perspective, a different aperture, et cetera, et cetera. So for African safaris, I kind of cycle between two different X-factor lenses, and oftentimes I'll actually bring both, but for the sake of this exercise, let's talk about the ultra wide angle end of the spectrum. This is going to be, you know, for crop frame sensors, kind of your 10 to 22, or for full frame sensors, your 16 to 35, things that are almost fisheye, but they are still considered rectilinear, meaning that they do not have that extreme distortion at the corners. They're meant to be like what your eyes see. So 16 to 35 is my go-to. The reason I really like this is it gives me an amazing, beautiful ability to photograph indoors, also in safari vehicles. As a travel photographer, I love getting that shot with the wildlife outside the vehicle. Obviously, that's the best place for wildlife to be, and the people inside the vehicle, best place for people to be, but getting it all in one scene. And that's hard to do with the 24 to 105 because it's not quite wide enough. For certain angles and situations, it might be, but that 16 is just, it's a whole different level, and it gives me those shots. Of course, you know, it's great for big, beautiful sunrise and sunset shots. It's great for blue hour shots or night photography too, because it does go down to 2.8. But yeah, great, great fun lens. Now, not exactly the antithesis of that lens, but a very, very different category. I also consider my Nifty 50, one of my favorite lenses in my kit, the 50 millimeter f1.4, super time-honored, venerable lens. It's great for portraits. It's great for travel. It's great for just really, really unique shots. And I do shoot at like f1.4, f1.6, f1.8 when using that. And it's all about getting that ridiculously shallow depth of field. And what you'll notice when using it is just about any photo looks really, really good with a 51.4 because you get that beautiful professional blur on things. So highly, highly recommend it. Between those two, which one is going to be more useful? Probably the ultra wide angle, but the Nifty 50 is so small, it usually fits in my bag with all space and weight considerations just fine. So by now you're probably asking yourself, you've missed a lens, Court. How in the world are you not talking about the big super telephoto prime lenses like the 300, 400, 2.8s and the 500 f4s and the 600 f4s, even the 800s? You know, what? Where are those in this kit? Aren't those the ideal safari lenses? Well, they're great lenses. They are expensive. They are big. They are heavy. The biggest thing that I have beef with is that you still need to cover that 100 to 300 range. You know, you need to cover that middle range. So all of a sudden you're adding a lens to this kit and it's a huge lens. It's an expensive lens. And if you have that lens on your camera, which you probably should most of the time, if you're gonna lug it all the way there and pay the money you would pay to get that lens, you probably will have a little bit too much firepower for a lot of the shots that I personally like. Yes, you will definitely have the lens and the telephoto capabilities to fill the frame with nearly every animal you encounter. But again, I think that that is becoming a bit of a thing of the past. I don't want to judge on preferences, but one of the photos that I really, really advocate for is to zoom out. We all get sort of obsessed and used to looking in the back of our cameras to judge in the moment whether it's a good or bad photo. And the reality is, yes, that's an okay way to review your photo, but you don't really understand the photo until you put it on your computer. And it's a whole different perspective when it turns from a 2-inch thumbnail on the back of your camera to a 27-inch photo on your big monitor. And all of a sudden, when you take those photos of wildlife that happen to be in the landscape that may have looked too small in the moment, and you say, oh, I only brought a 100 to 400. I really wish I had an 800 millimeter lens. Well, the reality is you probably like that photo way more than you think. So it's kind of a roundabout way of saying, yeah, the big primes are fantastic lenses. If you have one, absolutely consider bringing it, but you don't want to miss that mid-range of kind of what a 70 to 200 would give you. So all of a sudden, if we start talking about a prime lens, it goes from this very simple, very streamlined kit of basically two main lenses, 24 to 105 and a 100 to 400. All of a sudden, if you're going to bring a prime lens, you're starting to think about, well, okay, then why would I bring the 100 to 400? Should I bring a 70 to 200? Yeah, you probably should bring that instead. If you have a prime lens, well, what happens if there's wildlife close to the vehicle and you're stuck with a 500 millimeter f4? Well, probably ought to bring a second camera body. And so it kind of snowballs. Now, again, I don't want to badmouth that concept because you will get more photos and you will get better photos by investing in a large, expensive telephoto prime. But it's not going to be necessary. And if you already have one and if you plan on bringing that, you probably don't need the advice on exactly what to bring because you are probably a seasoned pro at that point. So I just wanted to put that out there. Now, the other part of all this that kind of follows up with the big telephotos is what about a 2x extender or really any extender, a 1.5, 1.4, whatever your camera manufacturer has on deck for you. And yeah, those are great, but it actually kind of goes into exactly what I was just talking about, which is primes. Telephoto extenders are made for prime lenses. They're not really made for your 70 to 300s and your 100 to 400s. If you put a 2x extender on a 100 to 400, a couple things happen. One, you decrease quality, I think sort of significantly. It really is all based on the initial quality of your lens. So the better initial quality you have, the less it's going to degrade when you put more glass, more workings between the lens and the camera. So If you have a really, really, really great lens like these primes, these big $10,000 super telephotos, yeah, teleextender is great. It's fantastic, actually. In some ways, I think a 300 millimeter prime f2.8 with a 2x teleextender is kind of one of the perfect safari lenses out there, that combination. But I don't usually recommend it in these forums because you're going to be set back $8,000 or $9,000. It's a pretty significant investment. So, you know, the first thing is you slap that 2x extender on a 100, 400, your quality goes down. The next thing is that your maximum aperture at 400, which turns into 800. And of course, if you're putting a teleextender on, you're trying to get beyond 400. So your maximum aperture at 400 is 5.6 without the extender. Usually a 2x extender adds two stops. So 5.6 to f8 is one stop and f8 to f11 is the next stop. So now you're shooting everything at f11, which is a pretty big F number, pretty small aperture opening for low light and to be able to blur the background and the foreground. So I just don't advocate for it. I think you're better off cropping on the computer if you really need to make that animal bigger in your frame. I find that between cropping on the computer and using a 2x on these sort of 100 to 400 style lenses is very, very similar. So unless you need to have every single pixel preserved, meaning you just can't crop your photo, I just don't advocate for it. I don't think it's worth it. Again, super telephotos, they do have a place. Those big primes do have a place, but it's not really my go-to for some of these safaris for all the reasons I said. And also, you know, there are a lot of weight allowances when you're going on these really exclusive safaris throughout various parts in Africa. You're using bush planes, you're using small aircraft that have very, very limited room. So it's a consideration. Just wanted to get that out there. We can move on. So additional gear beyond that, obviously a ton of memory. Plan on shooting 500 to 1,000 photos a day. If you are trigger happy and you shoot on burst mode and sometimes shoot at 10 photos a second, you might even want to double that. Oftentimes people will bring laptops because they have to download photos. There's no way they can bring enough high-speed memory cards to satisfy all that. So, you know, computer's up to you. It's not a requirement, but for the serious photographers or at least the little bit more intent photographers out there, being able to download, edit, review photos, see what they got, see what they missed, and then move forward each day or every couple of days is a really, really nice technique. Tripods are a huge question mark to me. Usually that's the kind of thing that really puts me over the space and weight. But obviously, when tripods are necessary, they are 100% necessary. What are those situations? Well, it's of course with slow shutter speeds, things like dawn and dusk when you might be photographing your camp or your hotel or the little fire pit where you're having a nice sundowner. These things, when you're shooting at a half a second, one full second for the effect you're going for, you got to have a tripod. Plain and simple. I love taking blue hour photos of my safari camp. Oftentimes the camp staff will put out nice lanterns and candles and it really lights it up just beautifully at that just after sunset period, that 20 minutes or so known as the blue hour. It is usually not a full hour. But yeah, I'm shooting in a half a second, a full second, making sure I can get really low ISOs and then sort of normal f5.6, f8 apertures. Yeah, it takes time and it takes a tripod because your hand really just can't be stable enough. So I do bring it for that. But then the question is, do you bring a full tripod? Do you bring a travel tripod? What is enough? You know, this is all about what other gear am I bringing? What are my weight allowances for safari? Oftentimes the higher end photo safari companies will give you a little bit of extra weight that you can use for those bush planes or for the vehicles. But nevertheless, I have a very light travel tripod, so I usually bring the full one. Anytime I bring my little travel one, I usually find that it's a little bit hard to use. I don't quite get the shot. So if I'm going to do it at all, I might as well just go full on with it. So beyond that, let's talk about, you know, main photography techniques. What are the things that we're going for when we're on safari? Well, obviously wildlife is the first and foremost, and maybe the obvious choice, usually everybody's first shot, is going to be wildlife portraits. So what do you do for wildlife portraiture? Well, the classic technique is to zoom in, fill the frame with the animal, the whole body, or just the face, or even a part of the animal, And then make sure that you get the fore and background out of focus, that nice blur or that bokeh, sometimes people call it. But the thing that people often don't realize is that when you're filling the frame with the face of an animal, meaning edge to edge, like the lion's mane is stretching from left to right, you want the background blurred, of course, so people instantly go for like an F4, F5.6, like very, very shallow. However, depth of field is in direct relation and direct proportion to the amount that the subject is taking up of the frame. What I mean by that is if your entire frame is the animal's face, it's almost like the animal's face is like the mountainside that you would be shooting in the landscape mode. You almost have to treat it like a landscape. Otherwise, you're going to get the nose in perfect focus, just like you might with the meadow in front of the mountain. But without a big depth of field, maybe the eyes won't be in focus or the ears won't be in focus or even the cheeks or, you know, whatever part of the animal. So my go-to for wildlife portraiture is of course, to try to blur that background. But I want to start at something like F5.6 and really F8. I start at F8. My technique is not so much trying to get that shallow depth of field by cranking it down to F2.8 or F4, but instead I'm looking to choose my background. So what I'm trying to do is get the animal's face all in crisp, beautiful focus with that texture and contrast of the fur, of the eyes, of the eyebrows, of everything. But what I want to do is I want to find a position, hopefully with my safari driver, where the background is relatively distant, meaning it is further away from the subject than I am to the subject. So the distance for me, the subject would be like, let's say X. I want the background to be like a multiple of X, like 2x X, meaning twice as far away from the animal as I am close to the animal. And what that does is that something like F8, it still blurs the background. So you get, you basically have your cake and eat it too. You get the animal in focus, crisp focus, really, really great depth of field on the full frame wildlife. But then that part of the frame that is indeed displaying the background, maybe above the neck, above the ears, below the chin, things that, you know, allow the view to expand into the distance, that blur of the background is going to be really, really nice and melty. It's going to fade away in a beautiful bokeh because you actually created that distance between the animal and the background. Now, this is sometimes easier said than done because you're in a vehicle that has to be at a certain distance or a certain angle of the wildlife. If you move, the wildlife might move. So it's one of the more difficult scenarios in wildlife photography to choose your background. But nevertheless, that is my classic approach to full big, big wildlife shots, is make the animal's face as big as I can in the frame and then try to find as much distance in the background. So another shot that I'm really looking for with wildlife is kind of in a way the opposite of what I was just mentioning with portraiture. I'm trying to find a very big, beautiful landscape with wildlife in it. And I term these my wildlife in landscape shots. And in a lot of ways, these are actually my favorite photos of any safari trip. Usually the first photo I take, or most people take, is going to be that big shot of the edge-to-edge composition of the lion's face with mane and perfect crisp focus. But oftentimes, you know, once you get past that, if you don't move on to these wildlife in landscape shots, you're gonna be really remiss when you look at your album at the end and you say, well, gosh, I got a lot of animals, but they could be anywhere in the world. They could be in a zoo. It doesn't matter because I'm not photographing the animal in its natural habitat, in its landscape orientation. So what to do here? Just treat it like a classic landscape shot. The brilliance here is not so much how you do it, but just making sure you always keep your eye out and always plan to zoom out. So this is why I really do advocate for bringing my 24 to 105 and using it a lot in conjunction with my 100 to 400. I will be at 100 a lot with my 100 to 400 because I want to get as much of that landscape in the shot with the lion in the bottom right-hand corner, with the wild dogs trotting across scene left to right, or the giraffe in the distance on the hill in the Serengeti. I want to make sure that I'm featuring the animal in its natural habitat in a beautiful way. So if I can find a beautiful landscape, awesome. Look for wildlife in it, and then the number one tip here is resist that urge to just zoom all the way in to 400, 500, 600 and fill the frame. Resist that urge, take some landscape shots with wildlife in it, and then of course do all the various composition techniques that you really need, like rule of thirds, golden ratio, et cetera, et cetera. So for those wildlife and landscape shots, you know, we're back right at F8, maybe even F11. Nothing too wildly technical about the settings. But let's move on into a little bit more of the technicality. Let's talk about shutter speed. These last two topics of portraiture and wildlife in landscapes are a little bit more aperture and composition oriented. But let's talk about shutter speed. So the classic default is, of course, to freeze motion. And you can do that very easily with shooting at 1 over 320, 1 over 500, 1 over 1,000, 1 over 2,000, kind of in concert with the pace of the animal. You know, trotting animals need 1 over 500 to 1 over 1,000. Running animals, you got to freeze motion at 1 over 2,000. And then you can kind of base in between there, or even lower. If you got a sitting animal, you can usually get away with 1 over 320. But nevertheless, you know, freezing motion is great. And we sort of all know how to do that more or less. For those of you with point and shoot cameras, you can just dial your camera to a little running man mode. It's like the sports mode. And that's going to reorganize every setting in your camera to prioritize for a fast shutter. But I really want to talk about this more in relation to slow shutter, because I think that slow shutters in sort of any wildlife photography can be quite beautiful. What we're looking at here is probably something around 1/20th of a second, 1/40th of a second, and not too much slower than that. But what I really like to do, especially as I'm riding around in my safari Jeep or safari truck, whatever it might be, is experiment with, if we're tracking or following an animal, is trying to take that photo while moving. And it's going to be a little bit of an avant-garde, a little bit of an interesting artistic impression. But if you can keep pace with that animal such that the animal is not moving a ton in your frame, but the background is moving, you're going to get this beautiful streaking of the background, the verdant green grass or even the dried brown grass, whereas the animal is going to be moving a little bit less. And what I like about this is it's something different. It's just simply try to get you to take different photos at opportunities when you might not otherwise take those photos. So again, slow shutter is something I highly recommend. When you're photographing wildlife with slow shutters, you usually don't need anything slower than 1 over 20, maybe slowest is 1/10. Beyond that, you know, anything slower than that, you're just going to get quite a jumbled up mess. But experimenting with slow shutter with wildlife, whether it's, you know, two lions circling each other, whether it's a chase or a hunt, just give it a shot, give it a try. So sunrise and sunset is really quite an amazing time on safari in Africa. And I highly recommend, you know, going with a tried and true photo safari company, because they're gonna get you up early. They're gonna know where the sunrise, sunset shots are. And this is my tried and true technique for taking those photos. So the first thing you're gonna want to do is, you know, usually put your telephoto on, which is usually the lens that I have first thing on in the day, my 100 to 400, and I'm going to zoom in to fill the frame with most of the color and most of the texture of the clouds and the sun and whatever those brilliant orange, yellow, and red colors are. Oftentimes people think, well, shouldn't I have my ultra wide or my wide angle on to take sunset, sunrise photos, either one? And yeah, you can get some cool photos that way if the entire sky is alive and on fire, but usually it's not. Frankly, some of the most beautiful sunrise shots I've taken are when it's a relatively small snippet of the horizon. It's just through that zoom telephoto power, you're making it appear bigger than life. You're filling the frame with those colors and textures. So having the right lens on is the first thing. The easiest technique to actually take the photo is to focus and meter in the same place, meaning that little center point autofocus spot is going to focus your shot on the clouds, so it's a nice crisp focus, but it's also going to meter your camera if you're doing anything other than full manual mode. And so what that does is a really quick and easy way. You focus and you meter all at once and you take the shot. By metering on the sun or the clouds, really one of the brighter spots of the area, what you're doing is you're actually darkening the scene quite a bit, so that anything else is going to be very silhouetted. Yet it's going to bring out the richness of those reds and yellows and oranges very, very nicely. And you really need to do that in order to express those colors in the scene. Now, the other thing I'm going to tell you to do is a little bit of a next level technique, and this is decoupling the exposure in the metering. So what you do here, this is a case when you have a nice foreground element that you want to get in focus, but a beautiful, rich background that you still want to darken. That background would be the sunrise or the sunset. You want to meter for the sunset, but you want to focus on the foreground. Again, the quick, easy technique is just to focus in the clouds and the distance and hope all's well. But if you find a scene where you need to decouple couple of those, that's what that little asterisk logo or icon is on your camera. It's a really ingenious little tool. What you can do, again, using your center point autofocus box, you can hover that over the sun and the clouds, hit the asterisk button. That meters, that actually locks the exposure for about 10 to 15 seconds. Most cameras is 15 seconds. And that allows you to then use your normal autofocus techniques to focus on the tree, the shrub, or even the animal in the foreground. So it exposes for the background, exposes for the sun, but you get to focus on something very, very close to you, whether that's a tree, a shrub, a building, heck, an animal would be awesome. One word of caution is, because you're exposing for the sun, usually what that does is it darkens your scene so much that the thing in your foreground is usually kind of too dark. It's silhouetted. Now, I shouldn't say too dark. It's silhouetted. That's often a great technique. But if you're going to expect to get any sort of light and color out of your foreground subject, again, tree, shrub, building, you really can't have your cake and eat it too. You need to expose your entire scene at one level, of course, unless you have like a graduated neutral density filter, which we can talk about in a little bit. But nevertheless, I highly recommend experimenting with this technique of the asterisk button. For some cameras, it's called auto exposure lock, or AEL. So depending on the make and the model, sometimes it's a button that says AEL, sometimes it's a little asterisk. Highly recommend using it, experimenting with it, because when you get the hang of it, it opens your opportunities up, especially for sunrise and sunset photography. Now, I mentioned this graduated neutral density filter. It's a big fancy word that basically means your filter is half of a sunglass tint and half of a clear tint. So imagine a circular filter right down the middle of that pie. The bottom half is dark, the upper half is completely clear. What that does is you can actually rotate that and put the dark tint where the sun and the sunrise is. So you can actually sort of forcibly, in a physical way, darken that. And that allows you to get a little bit more light out of your foreground. You know, honestly, I have one, I use it, it's fun, but it is, I don't know if I really recommend going out and buying one and planning on using it, because you can do this quite well in Photoshop and Lightroom these days, such that to go through the mechanical process and the trial and error on your amazing Safari, you know, maybe missing the shot the first few times while you learn the gear, I don't think it's worth it. But nevertheless, I wanted to tell you that the opportunity is out there, that the gear is out there. It's called a graduated neutral density filter. And a lot of real big pro landscape photographers will use these pretty religiously, because sunrise and sunset, or at least dawn and dusk, are such great times of day for that low angled soft light, that to be able to manually or physically darken part of the scene before they even get into Photoshop is usually a pretty big advantage to pro landscape photographers. So I gave you a teaser earlier in the presentation about the blue hour photography. I love night and blue hour photography when I'm on safari. And like I said before, it's because the camps are usually so beautifully illuminated in Africa, with the candles, with the lanterns, with the soft lighting, with the canvas tents, with the boardwalks, that it's a really, really great time. And you have a couple opportunities. So just after sunset, I like to probably have scouted some positions first, just to make sure I know where to go. Remember, it's getting dark and you usually can't freely walk around too much once the sun goes down. But if you have a couple scouted locations that are within your camp for some great inside camp photography, not inside the buildings, but, you know, within the sort of confines of the camp of some of the outside structures, it's a really, really great opportunity. So, you know, this is where the tripod comes into handy. You're probably going to want to take a 1 to 5 second exposure, and then you're going to want to use an aperture that gives you kind of classic mid-level landscape shots, like an f5.6. If you start going to f8 and f11, it's going to require you to take 30-second shots or really high ISOs, because it is dark. So I usually stick with f4, f5.6. I don't notice the depth of field being a problem when I'm focused on the tent and there might be buildings or tents in the background. Something that just gives me a little bit of speed, lets in enough light that I'm not sitting there for 30 seconds for each and every exposure. Usually I'm just taking a few of these on my way back to my tent in the evening, and that's about it. Night photography, is a very, very similar thing. But I honestly, you know, as far as like midnight photography of stars and all that, it's not the easiest thing, because once again, for most camps in prime wilderness areas, you just simply can't go out of the camp very far because of the risk of wildlife and the harm awaiting you if you stray too far from the security of the camp guards and the local communities and warriors that might be protecting you. So, you know, night photography is going to fall into the same category as blue hour photography. You can kind of push that blue hour until a little bit, you know, maybe like 30, 40 minutes after sunset. But I do think it's a fun thing to have kind of in your bag of tricks. It's not a cornerstone to any African safari for me, but I do get a lot of questions about it because it is, you know, you are in pretty pristine areas. It's usually pretty dark. You got some elevation. It's usually pretty dry. So you see some stars, but it's really often quite hard to do that. For those of you that are interested, though, however, I'll give you the quick and dirty lesson on astro and you know, real deal night photography. Is essentially, you know, what you want to do is look at the smallest f number, f2.8, f4, you know, nothing higher than that. You want to get in a great location, use your ultra wide lens because you want to get some sort of foreground as well as the sky. And then I generally start at like a 20-second exposure and an ISO of 400, 800, or even 1600. This is going to let in enough light that you can start to really, really see those stars, maybe even see some of the Milky Way if you're lucky. And of course, tripod is paramount. The thing you want to avoid is shooting slower than 30 seconds at a time. And it has to do actually with the rotation of the Earth, of all things. If you shoot slower than 30 seconds, the Earth will have rotated enough during your time that your shutter is open that you're going to get these little wormies in the sky. All those stars turn into little squigglies because they move as those lights move. So I usually stick with about 20, 25 seconds tops, and that gives me a pretty darn good amount of a light that comes in. And of course, I'm adjusting the ISO as much as I possibly can just to keep that low ISO. Noise and grain often express themselves quite badly in night conditions because you get big black pigmentation across the scene, and that noise and grain looks just kind of like rough sandpaper across that evenly colored black sky. So I do try to avoid that. Next is the question of where. Where, oh, where are you going to go on African safari? Locations across the continent. This is a big one. This actually has pretty big impacts on your overall safari. I can say there's no such thing as a bad trip, bad photo trip to Africa. It's going to be spectacular. But there are two distinct regions that I'm going to distill down into meaningful terms here. We've got East Africa and we've got Southern Africa. And of course, folks out there might say, well, what about Northern Africa? And what about, you know, Western Africa? And those are great. They are just not your classic safari destinations. We're thinking safari, like rumbling around in safari trucks, looking at wildlife, photographing. Those other areas are stupendous. They are different than Eastern and Southern Africa as far as the volume, the amount, and the diversity of wildlife photography experiences, really. So Eastern Africa versus Southern Africa. Quite different. There are similarities. Both are going to be your classic kind of safari experience, probably what you're thinking of. But I will say East Africa, specifically Kenya and Tanzania, are going to be more of your kind of probably, if you have no idea what you're getting yourself into, but you're just going based on like The Lion King and Out of Africa and other movies like that, East Africa is a little bit more of what you're probably expecting. Big, massive savannas, rolling, golden, amber waves of grain type hills, the lone acacia tree in the distance with a big sun setting and the giraffe. You know, just all that is East Africa. And, you know, it's not so much the entirety of East Africa. It's more of just the primary areas that have that safari infrastructure, namely the Serengeti and the Masai Mara. There are many other areas too, Kenya and Tanzania, but those, of course, are the most wildlife rich, and it's hard to go to either country or even to see an itinerary, especially a photo itinerary, without one of those. So Kenya, Tanzania, both spectacular. The Masai Mara and Serengeti are part of one contiguous ecosystem. The Serengeti is quite a bit larger than the Masai Mara, but that doesn't really affect wildlife per se. It affects a little bit about the seasonality. For instance, a lot of people like to go see the migration, the great wildebeest migration, which is about 1.5 1.5 million wildebeest and a million zebra and all sorts of other predators and prey that go along with them in this kind of, massive counterclockwise movement across the Serengeti and Masai Mara ecosystem. The reason that the Masai Mara is so famous is that it's probably one of the main vantage points for these classic river crossings where the wildebeest descend down the dusty slope into the crocodile-infested waters, cross, and then go up on the other side. And so what happens is as these wildebeest migrate in a counterclockwise motion, it's that Mara River that borders Kenya and Tanzania where most of that action is, where most of the herd sort of bottleneck, and you see the biggest volumes of wildebeest. You can see them from the Serengeti and the Tanzanian side as well. So both Kenya and Tanzania are really, really good at that time of year, which happens to be around July, June, July through September. The exact month you want to go is going to depend on which side of the river or which part of the Serengeti or Masai Mara you might be in. But I'm going to stop talking about that because that could just take the whole rest of this talk and this presentation. But just keep in mind that summertime or, the classic North American summertime is stupendous for your classic East Africa migration safari. Now, there's also Rwanda and Uganda in your sort of traditional East Africa safari portfolio, more or less. Uganda, Rwanda, much more known for their gorilla trekking safaris. That is indeed a quite a different phenomenon, quite a different type of photographic adventure. So I'm going to leave that to a totally different presentation, different talk, because the photographic considerations, the itinerary planning, the time of year, quite different. But nevertheless, it's worth mentioning that, yes, you absolutely can combine those, and it is very, very thrilling to go to East Africa, go to Kenya, Tanzania, tack on Uganda or Rwanda for a 4 or 5 day gorilla trekking extension. Stupendous. Really, really amazing time. So Southern Africa, what's the difference? Well, I'd say the biggest difference right off the bat is that you don't have that massive, massive savanna look. You don't have the Serengeti or the Masai Mara. You don't have the massive wildebeest migration. You actually do have migrations of other critters. There is a pretty substantial zebra migration that goes through some of the pans, the Makati-Kati pans, and throughout Botswana and even elsewhere in Southern Africa. There's huge elephant herd migrations in the tens of thousands. But again, because of the lack of bottleneck at rivers, in so many cases, Botswana and other parts of Southern Africa are big deltas and river systems. You don't have that bottlenecking in, you don't see 70,000 elephants all at once. So while animals do migrate and do move, and that's happening in Southern Africa too, you're looking more at kind of individual wildlife or smaller herds. I will say Southern Africa is pretty extraordinary because of the kind of quality versus quantity. The area is particularly Botswana, are flooded deltas. You might think that that's hard to get around, but the safari industry has absolutely figured a way to do that through use of safari trucks and even using metal bottom skiffs and Mokoro dugout canoes. It's a really, really dynamic, varied experience in Botswana. And countries like Zimbabwe and even Zambia are kind of following suit in some ways and mirroring that experience and capitalizing on the tremendous success that Botswana has had as a safari destination. Zambia is known as a little bit more of a walking safari destination. And Zimbabwe, also walking safari, a little bit like Botswana maybe 20 years ago. So Zimbabwe it's a great time to go there because the camps are a little bit newer in terms of more, I don't want to say pristine, but there's just an air of innocence, I would say, in the safari industry there compared to some of the other areas in Southern Africa, just because it's a little bit newer and the wildlife is really spectacular. Namibia is probably, the one country that doesn't look like the others. If you're in a multiple choice or in a game show, which one is not like the others? It's definitely Namibia, but not because it's not awesome. It is a really, really amazing area. And if you are a landscape photographer, oh, goodness gracious, Namibia takes the cake in so many ways. I often say Namibia is not really a place for a first-time visit to Africa because it doesn't have the volume of wildlife that the Okavango Delta does or has. It doesn't have the volume of wildlife that the Okavango Delta has. It doesn't have the ease of transportation that South Africa has. It doesn't have the lakes systems that Zimbabwe has, but the landscapes are incredible. So when you do see that wildlife, when you do see that giraffe or that desert lion, you see it, you know, in these incredible vistas of 500 foot tall sand dunes and huge craggy outcroppings. The sunrises and sunsets and desert landscapes are just beyond stunning. Absolutely one of my top choices for the person that's been to Africa a couple of times. Maybe you've been to East and Southern and say, well, what's new? What's on the docket? Namibia is that place for you. Definitely more of a landscape destination, but still has extraordinary wildlife. Don't miss Etosha National Park and the Ungava concessions around it. That is a very, very wildlife rich area. You combine that with some of the other places like Sasu's Vlei, the big dead Vlei with the beautiful sand dunes and the dead trees in the foreground, and you have this extremely well-rounded safari that is pretty much unlike any other safari you're ever going to have. But again, Southern Africa, it's a little bit more of a quality over quantity. There are more private concessions in Southern Africa than you would have in East Africa. Therefore, some of the rules are relaxed, like driving off-road, driving after the sun sets, simply because the number of tourists is so much lower compared to East Africa that the regulations to keep the masses at bay, more or less, they're relaxed because it is more sustainable in a lot of ways. I'm not saying that East Africa is going to be a total cluster and a huge crowds all the way around, but the volume of tourism is quite different. The private concessions do allow you to drive after dark, do get off-road, and your animal viewing, because of that, is really, really special. Much closer, the animals are very, very relaxed, and it's a great way to photograph Africa. Love it, love it, love it. So times of day, you know, if you go with a reputable safari outfitter, you are going to be probably waking up before sunrise, having a light breakfast, and then getting out for a pretty extensive morning game drive. That's one of the many positives of going with a proper safari outfitter, and you know, going on a specialized photo trip is even better because your drivers and guides are going to know how to angle you for the best light. They're going to know, you know, when to leave in order to get to this one area they have in mind for the cheetah or the lion or the leopard or the wild dogs mixed with that morning light. So it's just all things come together when you do, well, let's be honest, pay a little bit extra money and going with that reputable operator. But typically that morning time as the sun rises and then for the following 2 or 3 hours is the golden time. And then again, 3-4 in the afternoon, all the way up until sunset, that's another really golden time. A lot of times people think, well, gosh, driving after dark must be the most thrilling and rewarding and photo-rich thing possible because we're going to see all this stuff and these the bush babies and the lions. And it is cool. Like, trust me, it's a highlight of a safari, but it is really, really difficult to garner usable quality photos from that time. So I wouldn't get too caught up in that after dark period. Again, the primary times are going to be dusk and dawn. And any sort of proper safari outfitter knows that those big chunks of time at either end of the day are prime for not just photography, but also wildlife movement. And so again, everything comes together beautifully. So once again, you know, this has been an all things Africa, a sort of deep dive, but I didn't want to get too wordy. So hopefully this is helpful. Hopefully you enjoy it. Hopefully it's going to get you to Africa. That's the main goal. It's such an incredible place that we can call, you know, part of our wild world. And we're so privileged to be able to travel there unlike any other time in history. So if you can get yourself there, if you can go on a photo safari to Africa, absolutely do so. I hope this podcast gets you even better photos than you ever would have imagined. Thanks so much.